We're discussing the concept of originalism and the actions of Supreme Court justices in interpreting the Constitution. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. June is a busy season for Supreme Court decisions as the term wraps up. During October's confirmation hearings for then-Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett, she was asked about her views on interpreting the meaning of the Constitution. Here she is in her opening statement.
I believe Americans of all backgrounds deserve an independent Supreme Court that interprets our Constitution and laws as they are written. And I believe I can serve my country by playing that role.
What do you think about originalism in interpreting our country's laws? 800-642-1234. Lori Ringhand is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. She co-authored Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I feel like we're bookending you. We had you at the start of the term, and now we're close to wrapping up the term. And with conservatives now having a solid 6-3 majority on the high court, are you seeing any shifts?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about the big cases, or at least the cases that were supposed to be big that came out last week, is there's perhaps a little less of a shift than some people expected. The Supreme Court winds up its June term. It usually saves the really contentious cases to release at the end. And the two cases that were very highly anticipated and were supposed to kind of signal what the new conservative court would be looking like were maybe a little softer, a little more restricted in their scope than people anticipated.
What did you see there? What cases really came to light as you look at how the court is aligning?
Yeah, so there's two that were in the news last week that I think are really important and that illustrate where the court might be going, or what the justices are trying to do at this particular moment in time. The first is Fulton v. Philadelphia. The second is California v. Texas. And the two cases involve Fulton v. Philadelphia involves the Religious Free Exercise Clause. So we can start by talking about that one a bit. So this case involved a Catholic social welfare organization, and it's the foster care system in the city of Philadelphia. So specifically, what was at issue here was Philadelphia refused to allow this Catholic organization to participate in the city's foster care placement program because the organization refused to place children with same-sex couples. So the Catholic Social Welfare Organization would not place children with same-sex couples, and because of that, Philadelphia would not let that organization participate in the foster care placement system ran by the city. Mm-hmm. So this is keyed up as a big challenge to the court's current doctrine or current way of understanding the Free Exercise Clause. So the Free Exercise Clause, of course, prohibits Congress and later the states from prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So the idea here, the challenge here, was that by excluding this organization because they would not do something, place children with same-sex couples, that they believe or that they saw as prohibited by their religious beliefs, that that violated the Constitution and that the city of Philadelphia had to include them. So this was the Free Exercise Clause, as your listeners probably know, and the scope of religious exemptions, mm-hmm. when people are entitled to be exempted from general applicable laws because of their religious belief, is obviously a really big issue right now. There's a lot of contention around this. And this was keyed up as the case that was going to give the new conservative majority the opportunity to rework this area of law. And it really didn't do that. The case was decided 9-0, which kind of all by itself tells you that it was pretty narrow in its scope. We don't get a lot of big decisions out of this court that come down 9-0. So what the court did here was it found a fairly narrow way to hold for the Catholic organization. The Catholic Social Welfare Organization won this case, and Philadelphia has to include them. But rather than rework the entire free exercise clause jurisprudence to make it overall more permissive of religious exemptions from generally applicable laws, all the court said was that in this particular program, the city of Philadelphia allowed bureaucratic workers in the city, the people running the program, the program allowed those individuals to have pretty open discretion about when to grant exemptions. And in that context, when individual state actors are given the power to make discretionary judgments to grant exceptions to some people but not others, in that particular context, not giving an exemption to a religious organization did violate the free exercise clause. So it's a win for the Catholic organization and the advocates of more expanded free exercise protection, but it is on a fairly narrow ground and really leaves for the future the reworking of this area of law if the new conservative majority wants to revisit the laws that have been in place, the current doctrine's been in place since about 1990.
We're talking with Lori Ringhand, who is a Supreme Court scholar. She's helping us understand the approach of the Supreme Court, philosophy, originalism. You can join in 800-642-1234, what you have seen out of the court and in this term. So, Lori, another thing before the court, the Affordable Care Act, multiple challenges, over the years. And with the Constitution's Commerce Clause, Congress could not require individuals to engage in commerce. How has the court ruled with the ACA?
Right. So the other big case last week was the third of the major challenges since 2010 to the Affordable Care Act, also known, of course, as Obamacare. In this case, California v. Texas, again, it was also kind of teed as a big opportunity for the court to accomplish a long but perhaps dwindling conservative goal of overturning Obamacare. And again, it didn't do that. So this particular case, what this challenge looked like, you and your listeners may remember that the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, includes the so-called individual mandate. Mm-hmm. What the individual mandate does, the way it's structured, is it actually presents a choice in the statute where an individual can either carry qualifying insurance coverage provided either by their employer through employment insurance programs or through the state and federal exchanges where people can go and buy subsidized insurance that was part of the legislation as well. So the way the legislation works and the way the individual mandate works is people can choose. They can either have qualifying insurance through however they get it, or they can pay a tax penalty. And that tax penalty was an important, that structure of the law, excuse me, was an important reason why the law and the individual mandate were originally upheld when the court first looked at this legislation in 2010. And the reason that that structure mattered was John Roberts plus the justices that are generally a little bit more liberal combined to uphold the law as an exercise of Congress's power to tax and spend for the general welfare. And the taxing power is a particular power granted to Congress. Congress, as your listeners know, what our Constitution does is it gives specific powers or delegated powers to Congress, and Congress has to act within those areas of authority. And the taxing power is one of those, and it's one of the biggest. So the law was upheld and the mandate was upheld because it had this tax component to it. It was structured as a tax penalty or a choice to comply. So what happened now? The case from last week Well, what Congress did a year or two ago was it zeroed out the tax penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So while under the original legislation, you'd pay about a $600 penalty if you choose to pay the penalty rather than carry qualifying insurance, as of about a year ago, you'd pay zero. So the law is still structured this way, but the tax penalty is zeroed out. So now you either carry insurance or not. And there's no real consequence to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, a mandate without teeth is no mandate, that, as they challenged.
Yeah, that's right. And so that was precisely the challenge. The challenge here was brought by a coalition of states and a few individuals, and the challenge was on exactly that grounds, that when you that this was justified originally under the power to tax, because the legislation was structured as a tax choice or a tax consequence, and that by zeroing out the legislation, the law could no longer be, or zeroing out the penalty, the law could no longer be defended that way. And again, this was expected to perhaps be a big deal. And again, it wasn't. In a decision that did not split on partisan lines, the decision here was 7-2. So just like the other one was 9-0, this was 7-2. We see some coalition building here across the different ideological branches of the court. And what the court did was it kind of kicked the can down the road. It said that the challengers, the states and the individuals trying to bring this challenge to the taxing power, the use of the taxing power to accomplish this goal here, it said they didn't have standing. And what that means, standing, not anyone can just go to court and challenge a law because they don't like it. Right. If you think a law is unconstitutional or just a bad idea or unwarranted for some other reason, you can't. We don't just have general citizen standing where you can say, I don't like this law. I'm going to challenge it. You have to have what the court calls an injury in fact, some way in that the law harms you different from the way it harms anybody else in the country. And you have to be asking for a remedy that will actually fix the harm. So what the court said here is that because there's zero penalty, there's actually no real harm. There's no teeth to this choice anymore. So no one has been uniquely injured.
Well, let's pause here as we look then at coalition building along ideological differences of the court with law professor Lori Ringhand at the University of Georgia. How do you view justices interpreting the meaning of the Constitution? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lori Ringhand on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we discuss Supreme Court ideology on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Supreme Court confirmations are a partisan battle with life-tenured judgeships on the line. In 2017, Senator Mitch McConnell reflected on his most important moves as majority leader, filling Supreme Court vacancies with conservative appointments.
I think the most consequential decision I've ever been involved in was the decision to let the president, being elected last year, pick the Supreme Court nominee.
Do you think the Supreme Court needs reform? Should it be expanded? What does it mean to be an activist judge? 800-642-1234. We have University of Georgia law professor and Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand, who stays with us. Let's bring in Mike now in New Berlin. Hi, Mike. What question do you have?
Yeah, so I appreciate the call and the topic and the professor's comments. I just kind of wondered whether the professor had a take on this as being where maybe the justices, given the unanimity or near unanimity of the decision, if this is really a situation where the court is sort of saying, we're not going to wade into these decisions that the body politic can't resolve politically because they really are political decisions, and that the all of us together are so divided that looking to the court to try to provide us this kind of guidance isn't really appropriate, and that maybe that's the not necessarily the legal grounds upon which they decide them, but maybe more the motivations behind the decisions.
Mike, thanks. Lori.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I think the court right now is you have Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Elena Kagan, and the two of them sit on opposite sides of the ideological divide on the court. But what they share is they are both very, very pragmatic jurists. And I think what we're seeing in this last round of cases is a lot of work across that ideological divide, I suspect spearheaded by the two of them, to try to lower the profile or the temperature of the court in this current very, very contentious political moment. The court's very aware of its role in our politics and very aware of how it can often be used by political actors to drive different types of agendas. And I suspect that Justices Roberts and Kagan want to avoid that to the extent possible. Now, that's only going to go so far, because at the end of the day, we do we structure our legal system so that the justices in the Supreme Court are the entity that we empower to interpret some very opaque and open-textured constitutional language. And the justices are going to do that. And they're going to do it even in hard cases. But I think what we're seeing right now is that to the extent that they can sidestep that a little bit in this particular moment in time, there's at least some interest in doing that, at least in some cases.
Yeah, and iron out for us the concept of originalism, which would be like opposite of a living constitution. The constitution is a living document.
Yeah, well, let's start with originalism and kind of defining that term. So originalism as a interpretive methodology, a way of interpreting the Constitution, has become associated with more conservative justices, but there's a lot of kind of murkiness about what it means. So let's start by defining it. So when we think of interpreting the Constitution in ways that are consistent with its original meaning, sometimes people think about that as we have to go find out what Alexander Hamilton thought, or we have to go find out what Thomas Jefferson thought, you know, the famous founders. But that's not really what serious originalists do. What serious originalists do is they look for something called the original public meaning of the terms. And what that means is what would the public at the time, the people at the time of ratification, have likely expected this text to mean. And the reason that the originalists think that that's what matters, not what Thomas Jefferson thought, is that it is the act of ratification when the people in the individual states voted to accept or reject the Constitution as the nation's new governing document. It is that ratification vote by people that is actually what made the Constitution law. So what Thomas Jefferson thought about something might help illustrate what the people, how the people expected the thing to work, but it's only evidence. It's what the public expectation was that matters. So that's kind of defining the term. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say public expectation, though. I mean, maybe at a time it entered the Constitution at a time when women didn't have rights. People of color didn't have rights. There weren't gay rights, gay marriage, LGBTQ Americans not in the picture. So how does the court wrestle with that?
Right. So this is one of the challenges of originalism. And let me just finesse that a little bit to talk first about the advantages of it. This idea of originalism as an interpretive method, it's really appealing in many ways, and it's appealing for a very particular reason. It's appealing because it holds the promise of controlling judicial discretion, right? We give our Supreme Court a lot of power. We give it power to interpret the Constitution in ways that have the effect of nullifying laws enacted by our representatives. That's an awesome power. And much of our constitutional language is not very easy to interpret. It has very open textured laws or words, and originalism holds out the promise of constraining judicial discretion. And that's, I think, why it resonates with people, because that's a really appealing idea. The problem is, it doesn't always work that way, in fact, for a couple of reasons. One is which we often assume there isn't an original settled public expectation.
And
right?
let's pause there on the challenge and the friction there. Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand from the University of Georgia School of Law, as she explains originalism and the influences in court decisions. Do you think the Supreme Court is likely to restrict access to abortion now that there's a conservative majority? What do you think about the high court's decisions on major issues, gun rights? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Lori Ringhand after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how the history of the Supreme Court and the justices' relationship with the Constitution, how it all informs where we are today. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Originalism, as we've been talking about, bound by the Constitution's words. Where does that leave groups who weren't protected in the original text? Join in on the impact of controlling judicial discretion, 800-642-1234. We have University of Georgia law professor Lori Ringhand wrote a book on Supreme Court confirmation hearings, and she's with us for the hour. Rick is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions for the professor. The first one is, since the three-fifths compromise of the Constitution essentially acknowledged slavery as the law of the land and constitutionally protected, if you will, that an originalist then would have to say, since the Constitution was ratified, that was an acceptance then by the general public of slavery. So that's an originalist then would have to defend that position. Then the other question is, how does originalism differ from textualism?
Those are great questions. Thank you. So on your first point, yes. I mean, the Constitution was ratified. It had a few provisions that acknowledged the existence of slavery as a at the time constitutionally acceptable status in our country. And the ratification of the Constitution permitted that, right? And it validated that in that moment of time. Now, of course, the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendments unwound those specific provisions. But the bigger question of how, and this is Kate's question as well, how originalists deal with the issue of people who were not considered worthy of constitutional respect or protection at various points in our history are absorbed into our constitutional structure and our constitutional narrative. And I think this question or this problem raises one of the really interesting challenges to originalism as an interpretive theory, right? Sometimes the actual original intent of the people ratifying the language is to ratify a fairly abstract concept. Mm-hmm. When you look at the parts of the Constitution that we spend, certainly today, most of our time arguing about, they're not the text that reads like a legal code. It's not the part that says the president has to be 35 years old. Rather, the parts of the Constitution that we struggle with are the parts that embody these broad principles. They protect liberty. They protect equal protection. They protect due process. They protect freedom of speech. These concepts are deeply underspecified. Right. And sometimes the very reason they're underspecified is just like any sort of political process or political agreement. The founders were well aware that there was disagreement about how those would actually work in particular cases. So you abstract up. So we've abstracted up to a word like protecting liberty without due pro- or not not being able to deprive people of liberty or ensuring equal protection. We abstract up, and then each individual, as our country changes, those words and those constitutional protections, they're going to apply differently. And as women and people of color come into the orbit of constitutional protection, an originalist has to grapple with, how does this concept of equality or this concept of liberty, which are the actual words, they weren't specified to specific intent, they wrote in these words. What does it mean in 2020 for a woman to have equal protection? Right? Originalism as kind of a very, very specified original intended application doesn't answer that question. But that doesn't mean that looking at the word liberty and what it embodied and what it was intended to protect and advance can't be an originalist task. Right? Originalism can do that. It just has to recognize that the intent was not specific. The intent was abstract.
Rick, do you have any thoughts there?
Well, it has certainly been an education for me, and I appreciate the professor explaining how that abstraction makes things difficult. But I guess I would only once again ask the second question is, what is the difference between textualism and originalism?
Yeah, sorry, I lost sight of that one. I think they often pull in the same direction, but not necessarily. The idea behind a textualist interpretation is that you can understand constitutional meaning without going beyond the kind of four squares of the document, right? So textualists say we look very particularly at the words. And the words, if they can answer our question all by themselves, we don't go any further, right? So it would say we don't even have to look at what the original intended public meaning of this phrase was. If the words on the paper, without further kind of study or elaboration of things external to the document, can answer our question. So that's the difference. And they all are trying to get at this bringing some predictability and consistency to constitutional interpretation. But all the justices struggle with this. Justice Scalia, who was one of our more famous conservative justices, he liked to call himself a faint-hearted originalist. And what he meant by that is there are other values in legal reasoning and in constitutional interpretation that are going to matter sometimes too.
And Ginsburg would retort, "Dear Justice Scalia, you're searching for bright line solutions to problems that don't have easy answers. But the great thing about our Constitution," she said, "is that like our society, it can evolve." How do justices then and now grapple with going at these different philosophies and very different roadmaps to a legal decision?
I think sometimes we set this up as kind of an either or type of argument when really it's an area of emphasis with different justices. So there's a pretty standard toolkit that's used in legal reasoning. When judges or justices are trying to interpret constitutional text and derive constitutional meaning to apply to new sets of circumstances, they all really look at the same cluster of things. We look at precedent, and those are what has the court decided on this issue before? Precedent is an important rule of law value because it's important that there be consistency and predictability in law. So we look at precedent. We look at text, as the caller just mentioned. There's not a justice who doesn't look at what the words on the paper say, right? We look at the text because that is, at the very least, our starting point. Mm-hmm. We look at the principles embodied in the Constitution. As we were talking about just a moment ago, you know, the Constitution is not written as a specific legal code. It doesn't give us very careful, itemized lists, do this, don't do that. And it could have. These guys knew how to write a legal code. They didn't do that. Rather, they gave us words like equality and freedom and liberty. So you look at what were those words trying to do? What were they trying to protect about how a self-governing free society would work? And then you look, justices also are legal reasoners, look at consequences. What is the effect of this going to be? If we make this decision, how disruptive is this going to be to people's settled expectations about how the world works? And of course, we look at original meaning. That toolkit is pretty common to justices across the ideological spectrum. I think what differs is where they put their areas of emphasis in hard cases, right? And different justices in different topics will emphasize different things. And actually, the First Amendment is a good example of this, because originalism actually plays very little role in First Amendment interpretation right now. And the justices that we think of more as more conservative, they're okay with that, right? Mm-hmm. The current protection granted to speech is much, much broader than what the founding generation in all likelihood anticipated. But what it does is that that doctrine is built up from ideas, concerns about principles and freedom and consequence and mm-hmm. skepticism of government regulation. That's all part of the constitutional reasoning bundle, but very little of it is originalist.
Justice Barrett, she said in her confirmation hearings that she puts her children in the circumstances of the ruling and then decides how she might feel, you know, within, deep within. Do the justices' life experiences matter in how they are absorbing the text and how they are interpreting these cases that are argued before them?
I think it certainly has to, right? And the idea here, this came up a lot with Justice Sotomayor's confirmation hearing, right? Her experience as a Latina woman mm-hmm. and how that would influence or affect her jurisprudence. And a lot of things were said about that during her hearing, but I think the core idea is this, that everyone comes to a decision with a particular set of experiences. And how you view the question presented to you is going to be influenced by those different experiences. There's a part of Fourth Amendment law, which is about policing, that brings in this idea of what is reasonable behavior. You know, a person with one set of life experiences interacting with different types of officials might think it's reasonable to run away. A person with a different set of experiences won't think that's a reasonable reaction. And it's not that those perceptions trump the legal reasoning methods that we just talked about, but what they do is they bring nuance to how we understand what some of these legal tests and doctrines look like from different perspectives. So that diversity of experience, I think, is very important.
Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand of the University of Georgia with us as we look at the concept of originalism. Is there room for reinterpreting the Constitution and our laws as our world changes? Do justices need term limits, or should the Supreme Court be expanded? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lori Ringhand on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Talking about the Supreme Court last week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said a Republican-controlled Senate would block a potential nominee to the High Court by President Biden. It is a critical time for the Supreme Court and the judicial branch of government. What do you want to see happen? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We have Professor Lori Ringhand of the University of Georgia School of Law. She stays with us. Let's bring in Hans now from Merrill. Hi, Hans. What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just jumped on, so I don't know if my question is exactly germane to the conversation here. But, you know, a while back, the Supreme Court, when hearing, you know, gerrymandering cases, basically said, to the plaintiffs, political gerrymandering is wrong, but it's sort of not the Supreme Court's problem. And they said it's the, you know, it's the purview of state legislators to deal with that, which is a, you know, fox watching the hen house, to be sure. So I'm still struggling. A lot of people are still struggling with how on earth the Supreme Court came to that conclusion. It felt like a case that is specifically, you know, this is exactly what the Supreme Court should do, is deal with this type of issue, but they chose not to. Can you speak to that at all?
Sure. I have part of my work is in election law, so I am actually very familiar with this problem. And I think let me answer that by sharing why this is a hard question. Regardless of which way the court could have gone on it, I think it helps to understand why it's difficult. So the Constitution itself gives the power to draw legislative district lines, as your caller knows, to state legislatures. So the Constitution makes this a process that is operated by political elected officials. That's right there in the Constitution. Because of that, what the court struggles with and why it sees this problem as difficult is because the Constitution knowingly gave this to elected officials to decide where to draw lines, that means that there's always going to be some consideration of the political consequence of where the lines are. You wouldn't give it to political actors and expect them to not take the political consequences of line drawing into account at all. So the court kind of starts at that premise that there's going to be some political considerations in this process. And that, what the court sees as that fact, is what drives the court's problem. Once you say there's going to be some consideration of political consequences to where lines are drawn, then the court has to decide how much consideration becomes unconstitutional. And that's where the court gets stuck. The court says because there's always going to be some political consideration, you're giving us, if we make this a judicial question, we're going to have to decide how much is too much. And the court is very uncomfortable doing that. I think there were a lot of ways out of that conundrum, but that's the core nugget of why this is a hard question for the court.
Where do you see that changing at all? I mean, because the issue of gerrymandering is not going away, it probably is getting worse.
I do not see that changing. I think that the current court is not going to reengage that fight. Justice Kennedy, who obviously retired, was our most recent retirement. He was the one of the more conservative justices who was kind of open to this. And I don't see his replacement or the current crop of justices being open to revisit this issue. I think what is going to happen is the action on this is going to move to the states and to the creation of these independent districting commissions, and there'll be some constitutional lawmaking around that. But none of that is on the docket for the upcoming case. We've got some great cases on the docket, but not in the gerrymandering realm.
Well, let's look at the docket and ahead, and specifically on abortion, Roe v. Wade. In May, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case about a Mississippi law that prohibits abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. How could an originalist argument alter abortion rights in the country?
So this case, it's Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. It's coming up out of Mississippi. And as you mentioned, Kate, it involves a very restrictive Mississippi law that is clearly unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade. And this is seen as the case to allow the newly constituted court to challenge Roe. And it does, I'm glad you asked about tying that back to originalism, because it really does present an interesting case study in how that interpretive method works. So the right to abortion that was recognized in Roe was part of a cluster of cases or a cluster of rights that come up under the provision of the Constitution that says states can't deprive people of liberty without due process of law. And that area protects, it's part of the Constitution that protects a realm of privacy and family-related choices. Mm. So some of these cases, for example, I mean, this is the provision that gives you a constitutional right to send your child to a private non-religious school. It's the provision that, for, I mean, it's the provision that would protect you from a law requiring you to not have children or have children in the first place, right? There's this idea that there's a certain sphere of liberty that is encompasses these really important privacy choices about how you manage your own family, and the state can't interfere with that without really, really good reasons. So Roe and the right to abortion was decided in that bucket of constitutional doctrine. So tying that back to originalism. So if you're looking for a very specific original intended expectation, it is unlikely that the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment, which is where this provision lives, thought that they were creating a constitutional right for a woman, I mean, particularly a woman. This is, you know, the 1800s. Mm-hmm. They certainly did not have a specific intended application that they were creating a right for a woman to terminate a pregnancy. But of course, they didn't write that specific thing into the text. What they wrote was the protection of liberty as a personal right that the state can't interfere with without good reason. So then once women are fully or more fully incorporated into the group of people that we give constitutional considerations to, the challenge for the court is, what does it look like to fully respect the liberty and equality of women in this particular context? That is a hard question for originalism to answer. If it's just, did they have this specific intended application? The answer is going to be no. But once you say, what does liberty look like in this context? The question gets a lot harder.
And we'll stay tuned on that. So, Lori, we've entered now lightning round here. President Biden, you know, formed the commission to study changes to the Supreme Court over like 180 days of studying it. What are you watching for out of the commission?
I think the commission, it's a very well-rounded commission. I think they'll do good work. I think the range of recommendations could include court expansion. The number of justices on the court is not set by the Constitution, and in fact has been changed over our history by statute several times. I think a more likely recommendation is the imposition of 18-year term limits for justices. And I think the reason that that recommendation could potentially draw wide support is if we have a judicial vacancy, if justices serve an 18-year term, we'll have a judicial vacancy every 2 years. And that type of predictability really lowers the stakes on any individual confirmation hearing. And I think one thing many people might agree on is it would be a nice idea to take the temperature and the gamesmanship out of this process a little bit. Regularly staggered vacancies that arise every 2 years would give each elected president two vacancies and even that out, and might take some of the tension out of the current process.
Lori, thank you for joining us.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lori Ringhand, a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law, native of Wisconsin, by the way, earned her law degree from the UW Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.